Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, let's get right to it, because this great band you're hearing, the Westerlies, are winding down their introduction to Ampersand Live. Once a year, Ampersand Magazine hosts an evening of storytelling, poetry, and performance that reflects upon the unique nature of life in the Northwest. The magazine comes under the umbrella of Forterra, an organization committed to making our lives here more sustainable. It's a great cause and an inspiring event. This year's gathering took place at the Moore Theater on October 26th. Sonia Harris recorded the proceedings. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event and find links to videos from the performances, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Welcome to Ampersand Live, or Ampersand Live, as Dina Martina would say. Thank you so much for coming out. What an incredible turnout. We have almost 1,000 people here tonight. Give yourselves a round of applause. Amazing. My name is Sarah Rudinoff, and I'm going to be your host for this evening. And when Florangela and I sat down, I was looking at my notes from our first meeting and thinking about what I wanted to say tonight. And my notes said, people equals place. Now, I don't think that's what she said, because I know myself and I love to take random formatting doodles while I'm taking notes. But I kept thinking about that. People equals place. Now, you know, when we first meet someone and we want to get to know them, one of the first questions that comes up is, where are you from? Now, if I'm on vacation and someone asks, where are you from? I say, Seattle. I've lived here for 23 years. It's my home. I'm from Seattle. If I'm in Seattle and someone asks, where are you from? I say, Hawaii. That's where I grew up. Woo! Whoa! Yeah! If I'm home on Kauai, and let's say I'm at a grocery store and I don't want the checkout person to think I'm a white lady howley tourist, I'll answer her with, I don't need my receipt. Thanks, there. I'll speak a little pigeon to be like, I'm really not a white lady. And I think about this a lot when people tell me they're from Seattle. And I think, you know, when we get pissed off at the newly arrived techie who's just been here for 2 months, I like to think about what the Duwamish tribe might think, since their people have been on this land for 10,000 years. Yeah. So, in Hawaii, we have a distinction. There's Hawaiian, and then there's local. Hawaiian means you have Hawaiian blood, and local means you're from there. And like Seattle or any other place, being from there, there's sort of an undefined time that makes you more or less legitimate in your claim. But there's a real complex local culture in Hawaii. It's made up of Hawaiian culture and then the culture of everyone who came to Hawaii to work on the sugar plantations. Koreans, Filipinos, Japanese, Chinese, Portuguese, and missionaries, Europeans. We have our own language. Pidgin was just added as our third recognized language in the state. And who's ever had a plate lunch in Hawaii? Woo! So they say our plate lunch is sort of local culture in a meal. You have the European mayonnaise macaroni salad, the Japanese white rice and teriyaki, the Hawaiian poi and kalua pig, the Chinese chow mein, the Filipino adobo, kalbi short ribs. And I started to think, like, what would a Seattle plate lunch be? I was like, some tulalip clam fritters, some Norwegian pickled herring, some salmon teriyaki, some Ezel's best coleslaw in the world, some chicken tiki masala at this point, maybe with or without pho, you could get it. treating everyone who comes to Seattle really looking for a place to call their home as a local is the right thing to do. Yeah, give it up if you agree. And whether you've been here for 25 years or 70 years, treating Seattle as if we were her stewards and her guests and not her owners is also the right spirit. So tonight, I am very excited to hear from many different voices who call Seattle home. And I am thrilled to host this virtual table and to be fed ideas around it. So thank you for joining me, and let's start the show.
That is a European starling. Yes, it is the most common bird in urban places in the entire country, including here in Seattle. It is also, if you are a birder or a conservationist, the most hated bird in the country. So they were introduced here in 1890, came over from England, so they are a non-native, invasive, and very aggressive species. So for eco-minded people, they are reviled. When I found out that Mozart in Vienna in the late 1700s kept a starling as a pet, I was so in love with the idea. I was just captivated by that dissonance that here is this beloved, sublime composer of Western classical music who had as a cherished pet and muse for some of his work this most despised bird. So I got so carried away that I wrote a book about it, and as research, I raised a starling in my home. So I have to say that it is completely not legal to disturb the nest eggs or nestlings of any species in North America, almost. The Fish and Wildlife Departments actually encourage us to get rid of starlings in any way we can because of their non-native invasive status. So this bird was a chick in a nest that was going to be removed from a park bathroom in Seattle. So I sort of nabbed it on its way to the city park garbage bin. Isn't it ugly? It turns out that raising a baby starling is harrowing and difficult and time-consuming. That mouth needed feeding every 20 minutes from dawn to dusk every single day. But Carmen, her name, which means song in Latin, grew into a lovely plump, here she is in her young bird feathers, a delightful part of our family. There she is with our daughter, Claire. She oversaw the writing of the book, Mozart's Starling, and I don't know if you've ever tried to write with a starling on your hand. It's doable, but a little tricky. When Carmen was 4 or maybe 5 months old, she started talking. So most people don't know that, like parrots, starlings are talented mimics. So they imitate everything from the voices of other birds and animals to environmental sounds to music, which is one of the reasons that Mozart was so drawn to the starling, also to human speech. So the first words that Carmen started to say were the ones that we used when we interacted with her most often. So she'd say things like, Hi, Carmen. Come here. She imitated the meow of the cat, the squeak of our wood floor, and I'm sorry to say that it's sort of a common sound in our house, the cork when it comes out of a wine bottle. But it took me a long time to figure out that there was something even more astonishing and more important than just mimicry going on. Carmen does mimic randomly, so she's just calling out stuff all the time in the house. But most often, she mimics in context and in anticipation of what's going to happen next in our household. So when I walk downstairs in the morning and turn on the light, she jumps to the edge of her aviary and looks at me and says, Hi, Carmen. which is usually the first word that I would say to her. Then when our cat Delilah comes downstairs, she looks at the cat and she says, meow. And then I go over to the counter to make the coffee, and when she hears the tinkle of beans in the jar, she goes, rrr, the sound of the coffee grinder that she knows is about to happen. And I have one little snippet for you here. So what you're gonna hear is me opening and closing the microwave door, which Carmen will take as her cue to make the beeping of the microwave buttons. So let's listen. It's the door. It's pitch perfect. You can't tell them apart from the next room. The thing about it, though, is that it's not just Carmen. As wondrous and brilliant as we think the little bird that lives in our house is, it's not just her that has this playful and intelligent response, this kind of aural and vocal participation with the world around her. It is also the thousands of starlings that live among us every day. And the starlings remind us to take that lesson a step further and remember that it's not just starlings that have this brilliant participation and responsiveness to the world around them, but it's every creature that lives among us, from the earthworms unseen beneath our feet to the raccoons and the coyotes that wander our streets at night in our neighborhoods while we're asleep. All of them have their own sense of consciousness, of awareness, of responsiveness to the world that we all share. And this hated little bird that I live with reminds me that every time I step out into the world, and all of us do, we enter a great conversation, whether we want to or not. Emerson wrote that we lie in the lap of an immense intelligence. And I will just paraphrase the second part of that by saying, it means that it matters what we do. Carmen reminds me every day that it matters and reverberates when we walk into the world with kindness, when we walk with awareness of each other and the more than human world, when we walk with, I'll say, joy, with justice, with grace. We join all of the other creatures, common, reviled, loved, uncommon, as we walk together in a messy, sometimes contradictory, but intertwined beauty. Thank you.
I live on Bainbridge Island, but I'm from Georgia, where I was born and raised, where we never learned about the Japanese internment in my school. It was not a subject that was ever taught. For the last several years, I have been touring the country with a company called Living Voices, sharing this important time in history with kids who might not otherwise learn about it. In the last year or so, we've seen our country come dangerously close to repeating some of our past mistakes. With that in mind, I present to you this beautiful poem by Alan Chong Lau, who writes about a small plot of land in Seattle. So much has been erased, but one small plot of land honors a young woman named Chio Murakami and the neighborhood that was the once thriving Nihonmachi. The Garden at Higo by Alan Chong Lau. 1. An imaginary page from Chio Murakami's diary, 1936. South Washington, Maine, King, Weller, Lane, Dearborn, Jackson. These were the streets that formed Seattle's Nihonmachi. Our store on South Weller was started by my parents, Sanzo and Matsuo. This was my home. until I was 22. Bedridden from tuberculosis, I gaze out my bedroom window to the grass below. See our dog Skippy tail wagging under the Japanese pear tree. Nihonmachi kids play fort with our cardboard boxes, taking aim with pea shooters. When we burn everything up in the yard, orange flames lick a cloudy sky. Unable to sleep, I can hear the hushed prayers of Oka-san, Oto-san, Aya, Kei, and Masa slip up the stairs. I wish I could help decorate the store for Christmas, but I'll be gone before this whole neighborhood disappears. 2. Kobo comes to Higo. After the war, there were the missing and the dead. Not everyone came back, dispersed to wherever they could find work. But those who did found the Higo store still standing, saved by a pawn shop neighbor. Home again for those starting interrupted lives over in the reassembled architecture that follows hysteria. Like the emblem of a frog that once graced advertisements on a fading theater wall, the Murakami store returns from a patch of weeds. Surrounded from city streets, a garden emerges for the living. And yes, the branches of this 100-year-old tree where children once played still bear fruit. ありがとうございます。
I remember the first time I ran away from home. I was 6 or 7, and my biological mother was chasing me around our very small apartment because she was trying to whoop my ass. And I was nimble then, so I maneuvered the furniture like a professional athlete, made my way out the door, down the street, and into the wilderness. And there I sat, behind this tree, and I pulled the silence over my body like a comforter. And I felt the pressure of this tree trunk on my back, and I knew that I was at home. I stayed there until it was dark. And I was a storyteller even then, except it was the 90s, so most of my stories were adaptations from Oregon Trail, or I like pretended that I was Sacagawea and Lewis and Clark. Well, when I was in my 20s, my alma mater, which was it was a boarding school for poor kids, they approached me and they said, you know, Yehan, we'd like to start an experiential ed school and we'd love for you to come on board. And the plan was for us to take young people into the wilderness for weeks at a time so that way they could be challenged by the wilderness and themselves and then grow. But we were painfully understaffed. I worked long hours, and eventually the schedule was just too much for the wilderness therapy guides that we had hired, and so they quit. And I was like, hey, can I take their place? Because that's what I guess everyone would do. And my supervisor said, absolutely, sure. And I didn't have a formal wilderness education, but I remembered those trips I would take as a young person, and that's what I wanted to do with my 6th and 7th graders. And so we would go on these like midday lunchtime jaunts. Well, on one of our midday adventures, three of my girls approached me and said, Yehan, we have to pee. And I was like, oh, okay, great. So just like go that way and then we'll wait here and you pee and come back and join us. Well, when they came back, they were changed. And I looked at this pattern on their pants, and there was a pattern that looked like Florida had melted from their waistband all the way into their shoes. And it didn't dawn on me that when I said, you can go pee over there, I should have also said, don't forget to pull down your pants. So I stayed at that program for 3 years, and I built it up until it ended up closing its doors. And I found myself in this conversation with his name is Andrew Jay, and he lives in Seattle. And we had this great conversation about justice and identity and the wilderness and this need to get a more multicultural presence in outdoor education. And from that conversation, I got on a plane and decided that I was going to live in Seattle. And when I arrived, I knew again that I was home. That summer, I spent 72 out of 90 days in the backcountry with a map, a sat phone, a group of young men, and a co-instructor, and that was it. Now, even though I had spent the equivalent of years of my life in the wilderness, I still felt inadequate, because no one taught me to do anything. I just learned by doing and failing, and doing and failing, again and again and again. Well, one day, Andrew sent me this email, and on it was an application to get a free ride to this, to a 30-day course. I applied, and I was accepted to this 30-day backpacking and whitewater canoe course in the Yukon wilderness. Well, on our first nights in the backcountry, once I got into the field, my tent mate woke me up, and they were complaining of pain all over their body, so much pain that she couldn't walk, but she had to poop. So my instincts kicked in. And I woke up the other two folks in my tent, because when you're in grizzly bear country, you have to poop in groups of four or more. Hashtag poop train. So I put this woman on my back, and I carried her from camp with only the moonlight and our headlamps to guide us and these two sleepy guys in tow. And now I found this great pooping spot. So I rested her on a nurse log, and I digged her a cat hole. And then once I was done, she couldn't poop by herself, so I squatted, and she squatted, and I balanced her. And we held hands until she dropped a deuce into the cat hole that I had dug for her. And when she was finished, I handed her the pine cones that I had scavenged for her to take care of her other need. And then I stirred her poop with the pine cones in the hole. And I had only known her for 24 hours. My instinct in that situation was kindness. Now, a few weeks later, we were on the hiking portion of our course, and it was a late morning, and a bunch of us had decided to take a later start to our hike. And we moseyed our way up this hill, and we made our way to a ridgeline, and we were in the middle of this, like, impromptu lesson about reading weather when I heard someone say behind me, "Hey, is that a grizzly bear?" And so I looked to my left. And there was this, it looked like Pizza the Hut from Spaceballs, except with more hair, about 100 yards away. And then I heard a scream to my right, and it said, and the person was saying, "Get off of the ridgeline." And I turned back to my right to ask the person what they were talking about, when I looked up and I saw that the weather that seemed like it was miles away had changed to being right in front of us. Lightning struck. And then I saw this blur of yellow, and it was our lead instructor. Now, our lead instructor, when you see him, he is a man that looks like he would chop some wood, or he would like whittle you an arts and craft, like right in front of you in record time. He doesn't look like a runner. So when he took off, I took off. Because I guarantee you, I'm not going to be the first black person in the history of black people to ask questions first and then run. So he threw his trekking poles. I threw my trekking poles. He threw them again, and I went, mid-breath, are we leaving these here? No answer. I watched a peer of mine lose his footing and tumble the rest of the way down the hill. At this point, the grizzly bear had finally got wind of us and just saw this mob of people just running toward it. And I went, are we literally running toward a grizzly bear to avoid getting struck by lightning? Silence. So we made our way down the hill. And my peers, some of them were crying, some of them were covering their heads, and I just lifted my head and let the hail that had started to come down on us just hit my face. And I started to sing. And I realized that some people have their instincts really tuned into environment. And even though I felt like an imposter, all I had to do when I was in the wilderness is do what I knew. Thank you.
Wow. Wow. You know, I love Ampersand Live. I hate following acts like that. So here, I'm your interlude. You know, like in a Greek play, the guy who comes out and tells you what it's really all about. So Forterra is in this continuous conversation with all of you, with this place, how to make the Pacific Northwest the best it can be. Sustainable, resilient, a conversation about, if I got this right, our wildlands, a conversation about our cities, and something more fundamental. Fundamental about who we are and what we need. Now, this came to me in startling, startling clarity about a year ago at Ampersand Live 2016. It was 2 days after the presidential election. Can you imagine that? Right? So there was Tomo. Look, I'm not keeping up here. There was Tomo. He had just finished his jazz piece, and he segued into the civil rights anthem, We Shall Overcome. And right like that, the audience was with him. Right there, I was gobsmacked. I was stunned, and I got it. I knew it. It is not good enough just to work for a sustainable landscape unless you are working for a sustaining community, a place that cared. Now, if we are not working for both a sustainable landscape and a sustaining community, we risk getting neither. And that's not just a clever marketing slogan, though I kind of like it. It is really built into our DNA, absolutely embedded in our DNA. So let me convince you of that. Let me convince you of that by taking us away from this time and this place. In fact, taking us back and reacquainting us to our very first ancestor. Now, we don't know her name. I doubt she had a name, and if she had a name, I know she couldn't speak it. But we call her Lucy today. So we don't know much about, we don't have much about Lucy anymore, but this, a few bones. But science allows us to reanimate, science and a little bit of art, allows us to reanimate those bones to this. Now look at that face. I mean, look at that face of, besides those cheekbones that any movie actor would kill for. Look at those eyes. Look at the dawning, the beginning of our humanity in those eyes. And then look at the wariness behind that, those eyes. The wariness is well earned. There's a good reason for that wariness. These are some fossilized footprints from 150,000 generations ago when Lucy was with us. 150,000 generations ago, one of Lucy's sisters ran across that stream bed to probably the safety of a clump of trees. And right alongside her are those little footprints. And you can just see that Lucy's sister's hugging on to her daughter as they scamper to safety. That is part of our shared deep history of a very unyielding and unforgiving environment. So now let me half that distance. Let me take us from 150,000 generations ago to only 75,000 generations ago. And we were Homo erectus. Erectus because our posture is much like it is today. Now, there are a lot of bones of Homo erectus. They're scattered all, Homo erectus got everywhere. They're scattered all around the world. And so we can build a pretty good model of who Homo erectus was, what we looked like. We looked like that. Now look at that face. And you can see more humanity in that face after 75,000 generations. But you also see a confidence. Look at the jut of that jaw, huh? So there's a good reason for that. And the good reason is this. This crude tool, it's called a hand axe, you know, is handled in it just like this, just like you can imagine. And it was what began to cleave us away from our natural world. It was the beginning of the way we could start to control a very uncertain and scary place. So think about that. For 75,000 years, we have been enacting the very essence of our human condition, this need to control and dominate our planet, and also the humanity that helps us teach us to sort of live with what's important, live together and side by side for 75,000 years. So now let me take you up to much more or less today, Homo sapiens, to give us our full scientific due, Homo sapiens. And so I'm not going to show you pictures of us. I'm not going to show you our bones, but I'm going to show you this. Now, scientists call those flutings. You and I call them finger paintings. Look at the exuberance, that sort of human exuberance and excitement to humanity in those finger paintings, right? Now, what science does tell us, and I think this is thrilling, that those finger paintings were made by a child between 7 and 8 years of age. And in fact, made by a girl child, 7, 8 years old. That finger painting is from a cave wall in southwest France, about 6.5 feet up. Let's see, yeah, about 6.5 feet up. So think about that. That little 7 or 8 year old girl was probably on her mama or daddy's shoulders. So there they were, just like today, 8,000 generations ago. Think about that. 8,000 generations ago, we had the very spirit of our humanity today. Standing there as if it's a day in the park, mama and daddy together playing, the girls probably giggling as they do this finger painting. And that's not a one-off shot of our deep humanity. I can show you pictures like that from all around the world. Let me show you one more from 2,000 generations ago. I think this is stunning. Look at all those hands. Now, those stencils made 2,000 generations ago were people like us who put ochre in their mouths and then sprayed it over their hands. And if you look closer at those hands, there are big ones and little ones. So clearly, there are old people and young people, middle-aged people, all there in this incredibly cacophony of joy, cacophony of humanity all together. And that's us, too. That's our humanity. So there we are. And that's what we need to think about today, is that if we want to have a sustainable region, it's about really us. It's about a sustaining community, a place that cares. So if we want our wild landscapes and we want our great cities, it's really about us. And that's what the rest of tonight, this continuous conversation, is about. Thank you very much.
When I was young, I was in a summer mountain biking camp in my hometown of Ketchum, Idaho. One day, I remember charging down a bumpy forest road. I was ahead of the group, going pretty fast, and I drifted into a road rut. Which, if you know anything about mountain biking, it's not the best situation to be in. Suddenly, when I looked up, I saw a white mass blocking the road. Being the novice mountain biker that I was, I panicked. I turned my wheels, caught the rut, and flew over my handlebars. When I opened my eyes, all I saw was white. I heard obnoxiously loud sounds, and I realized I had almost run into a flock of about 1,000 sheep. Since that crash, I've wondered, what the heck were all these sheep doing in the mountains? Why were they there? And who was this man with a pole poking and yelling at them? To this day, I still have a scar on my hip and a lasting curiosity for mountain sheep herding. And for the past year and a half, I've been following the last large-scale sheep herding operation allowed on forest land in Washington State. Throughout the summer, flocks of sheep traverse mountainsides. They're guided by migrant sheep herders. Most of the herders have been doing this work for over a decade. All come with one mission: to provide for themselves or their families. But it's not without sacrifice. The herders learn husbandry knowledge in Peru. They come to the States under the H-2A visa program. They work for 2.5 years straight before returning home to Peru for a short 3-month vacation. After their vacation, they come back to the States and do it all over again. They work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, earning about $1,200 US a month. They miss birthdays, holidays, and everyday family moments. They spend most of their year alone with their herding dogs. Trailers provide shelter, and in their downtime, they listen to Peruvian music on the radios or watch DVDs of family parties back home. The sheep herding cycle starts in late spring. Sheep are loaded onto trucks, and each herder is assigned a flock. They first move through low farmlands and then make their way up to the mountains between Ellensburg and Wenatchee. The herders walk hundreds of miles, moving their sheep vast distances in order to make sure that they feed and grow. They are constantly aware of their sheep, in tune with the forest and their flock. They are never lost because they follow pathways they have walked for years. And if sheep stray, they aren't hard to find. Their faint sounds, nibbled grass, or the herder's recollection of where they foraged the year before clue them in. If the herder hears his dogs barking, he thinks, is it a bear or a cougar? If they see vultures circling above, they think maybe a sheep has died. The work is demanding, vigorous, and never-ending. They sacrifice their social and family life to be able to earn a living wage. I started this project because I wanted to learn more about sheep herding. I continue because I want to spread awareness to how difficult this work is. I wonder, without these migrant workers, would this age-old tradition still exist? For now, I'll keep taking pictures and searching for answers. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Are we having fun tonight? How fantastic to look out and see 1,000 people here to talk about nature and think about people and place. What a thrill. So I write almost every day, but this morning I got up early and I wrote this, especially for you. I want to talk about a miracle that is in our midst, trees. You know, they're not just standing there. They sustain a vast suite of lives above ground and below. They're connected, they're communicating with one another through networks of roots, mycorrhizal fungi laced all through the ground. And they feed hundreds of species with their acorns, their seeds, and their leaves. And they sustain us, creating the oxygen that we breathe. That is our beautiful connection, so intimate, our shared breath. Each time we exhale, we feed the trees around us, and with each new breath, we take in the gift of trees' pure, sweet oxygen. What is it that is so captivating about trees? In our ephemeral world, trees contain time. Trees were here long before us on this earth, and their lives are so much longer than ours. We all know a tree that we love. We take comfort in the fact that it will be here long after our soft, squishy, effervescently mortal selves are gone. But here's the thing. We are changing trees. Deep in their living, breathing, endlessly creating essence, with the exodus of our humanity, all of our works, that carbon dioxide we breathe from our bodies, trees can manage that. They even need it. But from our factories, cement plants, cars, and coal, that is more carbon dioxide gushed into the atmosphere, millions of years worth, dumped just since the Industrial Revolution that trees can't absorb. So, it stays in our atmosphere, cooking our planet. I spent a year at the Harvard Forest living with a single 100-year-old red oak tree to learn through the life of one living being how we are already changing our world. There it is. With the help of dendrologists, biologists, ecologists, mycologists, every ologist you could think of, I learned how, over the past 100 years, the frenzied thrust of our carbon love affair is changing trees. My red oak, my witness tree. So, here's what we learned. It's growing faster than ever, feasting on all that CO2 we've spewed into the atmosphere. You can see it in my trees, galloping rings, growing bigger, fatter year upon year. It is bench pressing carbon like a teenager and doing all that while barely taking a drink. It's closing down its stomata rather than opening wide. You know, those little breathing pores on the underside of the leaves. For why lose more precious moisture than you have to when you can get all the food you need, that CO2, from just a sip of air? So laden now with 400 parts per million of carbon and counting. And I learned that our hands, humanity's hands, are on the very seasonal clock, that beautiful gyre that winds the year. Spring is earlier, fall is later. Winter is squeezed on both ends. The growing season is now so long, the leaves fall off my tree as if it's exhausted, even as the weather remains warm, even into November. For there are two seasons now, the ancient timing of my tree's ancestors baked deep into its DNA, and the seasons made by us. So, we hurtle forward into a rate of environmental change faster than anything in the last 100 million years, an aberration virtually without precedent in our planet's 4.5 billion year history. And yet, nature is brilliant, resilient. Life itself is the most powerful force on Earth, and it will continue with or without us. The choice is ours. To continue on this beautiful planet to which we are so suited, to savor the beauty of nature, the glimmer of this frost on these delicate twigs, it was gone by mid-morning, but there to see and enjoy that and 100 other miracles every day, each hour, as I lived with my tree. All this is told in the book that I wrote, just published, about my year with my tree at the Harvard Forest, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change in a Century-Old Oak. So, here's my question for you, each and every one of you. Where is your witness tree? Is it at your grandmother's house? Is it outside your childhood bedroom window? Is it the tree you watch each day, each year, outside your kitchen window? It is your friend. It is your anchor. Honor it. Love your connection to your chosen place. Let it flourish. Savor it. Defend it. Pass it on. Know that if humanity is to live long on this dear, sweet earth, it will be from that love, that wellspring of caretaking by people, each and every one, every day, for the place that we call home. Stand up for this place. Thank you.
It feels like I spent half my life crawling through the muck and the other half getting chased around by something that wants to eat me. Which is odd since I never set out to be a nature photographer. I grew up between a trailer park and a chicken farm. Where I'm from, nature is mostly poison ivy and junk cars and busted beer bottles. When I started out, I was going to be the next famous war photographer. But my first job was working for a small town newspaper back east. I showed up that first day with dreams of journalistic glory. The day-to-day was a little less dramatic. Instead of my editor sending me out to combat, they sent me to the county fair, to an endless string of high school football games. I mean, once in a while, we'd have a small bit of drama and mayhem, like a car wreck or a house fire. But when all else failed, I'd just drive around, hope that lightning might strike. Artistically or literally. It felt like I was telling the story of my hometown one day at a time. And after a few years of this, I found myself at another paper up in Alaska. It was the same daily journalistic grind, but there I might wake up and find a moose on the front porch, bald eagles on the drive to work. And I looked up from the camera and saw my new hometown was surrounded by miles of scenic wonder. I abandoned the trenches of daily journalism and tried to tell some news stories about wild lands and wild animals. But from the elephants of the Kalahari to the salmon of our Pacific Northwest rivers and even down to Antarctica, there remains only a hint of what once was there. And I spent a good part of the last two decades chasing shadows, it seems, the ghosts of the vast untouched wilderness that once defined our world. I've wandered further and further afield. For some reason, I'm always like traveling alone and doing things the hard way. Is it because I'm stubborn, cheap, and disagreeable? Rumor has it. But I found the lessons you remember are the ones you learn the hard way. They say all the easy pictures have been taken, but I'm here to tell you there are some stupid ones left. You know, nearly all of my trips have been do-it-yourself expeditions in that Land Cruiser across Africa, or by boat to Southeast Alaska to photograph humpback whales at close range. Oops, there we go. On foot near Kodiak Island, to walk among the grizzly bears out by the Katmai Coast. And most recently to Hudson Bay and Arctic Canada to photograph polar bears. I mean, these are the iconic species of the North. They're the poster children for climate change and all that we stand to lose. I wanted to see these bears, but not in some overcrowded, overpriced tundra buggy. Rather, as the first people did, one-on-one, eye-to-eye, on the polar bear's terms. I figured pretty quick this was going to be a BYOB job. Bring your own boat. The maps told me it was 2,000 miles from Ballard Bridge to the end of the road in northern Manitoba. All I had to do then was get my tired old boat, named Seasick, halfway across the continent, put her into some unknown river, float 75 miles down to Hudson Bay, hang a left, and 800 miles later, I'd be at the Arctic Circle. The boat was perfect for a weekend fishing trip in the San Juans, but as for months of travel and uncharted icy water, we'd see. So I gathered all my smelly long underwear, dinged up cameras, crammed it all into waterproof cases, and then I went shopping. Came home with three GPSs, two depth finders, an entire set of nautical charts to the Northwest Passage. Better safe than sorry. When I got to the end of the road and back seasick into the Nelson River, there was just no turning back. And for weeks, I was plagued by bad navigation and worse weather. I was either running aground on the rocks or being battered by storms. I went out looking for ice and for polar bears, and for the first 6 weeks, I saw plenty of neither. Then, after nearly 1,000 miles, the ice found me, almost crushed the boat. I had to run seasick aground on a rocky beach, on purpose this time. But when the icebergs finally moved off, the world was transformed. I was surrounded by icebergs and hundreds of walrus. I mean, it was like a vision from two centuries ago. And when the iceberg, there were dozens of polar bears on the hunt, and it was magical. And it also scared the hell out of me. I mean, I was trying to create these intimate pictures of bears, and that meant getting as close as I could to photograph them stalking and hunting on the ice or swimming through the water during the summer melt. I mean, most times the bears wanted nothing to do with me. And yet other times they came way too close for comfort, sneaking up to for a look in the boat's window, like they come over to borrow sugar, taking a bite out of my camera, or tearing a big hole in the side of my inflatable Zodiac. But, I mean, it felt like I had stepped back in time. I was usually scared, cold, and absolutely miserable, but traveling in a land where polar bears ruled supreme, I was just an onlooker. I mean, I was there as a witness, and it felt like maybe I'd become that war photographer of sorts after all. I mean, what is the most important conflict of our time? Isn't it man's ongoing war against our own planet and the animals that once thrived here? I can't keep track of my car keys most days, so I don't imagine I'm going to change the world anytime soon. Not on my own. But for four summers, I went back again and again to the Arctic and tiptoed up to the edge of disaster. I wanted to try to tell the story of one of the world's last great wild places. And I wanted to create a lasting record and show that these lands and those animals are worth remembering and protecting. Thank you.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This ampersand live event took place on October 26th at the Moore Theater, thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can find the full event on our website, kuow.org. Tune in again soon.